It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kingsley, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we explore the intersection between art and science to create interaction between artists and scientists in the community.
I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at Indiana University School of Medicine and Faculty in Communication.
And before we get into our conversation today, I really want to express how saddened we are with the passing of my longtime co-host Jill Dittmeyer several weeks ago. And Jill really helped make this show possible through her, I think, professionalism, her ability to be both a broadcaster and a teacher. We're going to honor Jill today and have her spirit live on in that we're going to continue doing these shows into the future. And I'm so glad to welcome Krista as my co-host. And that makes the transition for me so much easier. Thank you, Krista.
Thanks, Mark. Jill is going to be an incredible hole to fill in the Indianapolis arts community. We'll miss her a ton.
I agree. So today's conversation, we're going to focus on really fun stuff, geology, crystals, glass artistry, and architecture. Wow, that's just a lot all in one. And we have with us today two really special guests. One is Alan Spencer, who's an art educator, a glass artist, and a geologist. So this, Krista, is really exciting because we get an art science person in one. And we also have Thomas Huff with us, who's an architect and the senior education facilities planner at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And Alan, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself and get us going?
Good. Well, I learned my education in geology at the College of Worcester and worked as a geologist over in Indianapolis for about 5 years before moving back to Ohio with my wife and starting my own art studio. I did sculpture work in ceramics and woodworking, and eventually started my own glass blowing studio here in Ohio. I did that for 15 years and then decided to go back to school and get a education degree. And after getting that degree, I started teaching in the Worthington school system, which is a public high school in Worthington, Ohio. And I teach ceramics sculpture classes there. I've been teaching there for 18 years now. And I right now I do my own artwork, mostly ceramics. Most recently I did a series of ceramic vessels, 12 of them for each of the different geologic periods with fossils on each vessel that pertain to that particular period.
Cool. And Thomas?
I come from a architecture originally, and I started off as an architect. I realized early in my education and practice that I was really more interested in the underlying causes of why we do what we do, which led me into urban design and planning, which is what I did my graduate work in. So I've really, from graduate times on, alternated between working as a consultant, doing the actual design and planning as a consulting leader, and switched. I've switched a couple of times in my 45 years career between working in private higher ed institutions and public. I got my feet wet in Iran in the Peace Corps out of school. So I've practiced doing higher ed planning and architecture in other countries as well, which has been an enriching experience. But I would say I've always been interested in the whole issue of glass and well-being, you might say, but the focus recently and how it, I think, intersects with some of the things we'll talk about in this hour is the whole issue of sustainability and the much deeper dive that people have been doing, particularly in this whole area where we've been dealing with lead and with in what really has to do with the well-being of people inside spaces where we spend 90% of our time, other than, unless you're a farmer, you spend 90% of your life indoors, but we never paid very much attention to how the indoor environment affected our sense of well-being. And that's where I think this whole conversation about glass is really central to all of that.
One of the things I think that is an interesting intersection of your work, and Tom, you touched on this a bit, so maybe we'll start with you, is to talk about glass in both form and function, right? Sort of how glass, it, like you said, sort of enriches space, enriches our life from an aesthetic standpoint, but also has important, you know, important implications when it comes to something like education. We're talking about natural light, or as you said, some of the environmental impacts for buildings. So could you talk kind of more specifically as you're thinking about your work, how you think about the role of glass, both in terms of that aesthetic value, as well as that, you know, the sort of value that it plays in the architectural process?
Well, I think it's part of the whole central thing about well-being, I think. But what I think has become more and more interesting to me is that in this last 20 years of concentration on sustainability as an issue, where building materials and the things we use to build with, glass was always thought of as in a sort of a nice but negative way, because traditionally it, you know, single pane glass was what we had. It had very big downsides in terms of you know, heating and cooling and solar gain and the reflection off of the western sun that you can barely control. So we were fighting between the indoor environment and human well-being. You know, they were sort of at odds with one another. But what's so amazing about glass and our intentions now, the technology, I would say of all the building materials that we deal with today, glass has technically improved and changed far more than any other material. It's just the things you can do with glass now that we could go into are just totally extraordinary. And that changes our way of thinking about the aesthetic issues that you raised too. You know, that the early glass boxes, you know, were actually kind of derided by a lot of design critics as being boring, you know, just terrible examples of lack of creative thinking about architecture and design. But now that we understand it has this other aspect of opening up the outside world to those inside the building, rather than just judging it from the architectural critics in the Sunday paper that said, "Oh God, here we go with another glass box." You know, or have been sort of put back in their place a little bit by realizing, you know, what glass really can do for us as the people inside the building.
Great point. I think about the sort of very memorable, very well-known glass structures, you know, the entrance to the Louvre, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, right? Sort of really beautiful glass structures, both from the inside and from the outside, and the extent to which that shapes the way we understand the art inside the building as much as we do understand the building itself.
Yep, absolutely. And now the stuff that's, not to jump too quick, you know, some of the stuff that's really amazing, we just built a pretty amazing award-winning design building on our campus that we really went all out to say, if we're going to train designers, why shouldn't the building they are learning in itself be kind of a laboratory of what is the cutting edge? And we designed it with a heavy timber structure instead of steel and concrete, because that's the latest sustainable thing. But we've employed dynamic glass in all of the windows. And dynamic glass means the glass itself controls the solar gain of the building to the point where it can let in winter sun and heat, but reflect back out. Reflect out the summer heat and let in the winter is what I meant to say. But it's also manually controllable. So we now no longer need blinds and curtains and all those other things, which adds to the whole thing about people's well-being. So now you can control those aspects of the visual environment outside that you don't want. You can also do the same thing. Think about conference rooms and other places where you sometimes want to see in and sometimes you don't. It's just amazing what glass can do now for those of us that occupy spaces and want to control them, but want to see each other or see out.
So that concept of well-being, Alan, that is something that why stained glass, blown glass, those all have been a part, I think, the arts contributing to the well-being of humans. That's why we create them. We like things of beauty. Just like you're saying, Tom, it's an art form when it becomes architecture. Alan, where did glass come from to even begin?
From what I understand, early times, about 2,000 years ago, over 2,000 years ago, some person somehow was making a very hot fire where there was some sand, and obviously some other materials got mixed in with it, like some ash material. And if you get it hot enough, a fire hot enough, and include those materials, mainly silica and ash material, the ash lowers the melting point of the silica to the point where the sand can actually become molten. And through time, they figured this out and used that material once they figured out how to control the melting point by adding materials to lower the melting point, because the melting point of pure silica is about 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So you have to use other materials like soda ash or limestone to lower that melting point and get the material to be a little bit more usable and be able to withstand the elements of time. So eventually they figured those things out and started casting. That was the first way that they work with glass, was they would typically make a mold on a piece of a wood or metal. And the mold was quite often made out of a brick-like or straw-like mixture. And then they would melt the glass and actually wind the molten glass onto the outside surface of the mold. So they didn't initially start blowing. They would make vessels by casting the glass around the outside surface of the mold. Eventually, they were able to get the glass hot enough and control it inside of a furnace, and then they could start blowing glass. And then eventually in time, they were able to make flat sheets of glass, and that's how we do stained glass now. We color glass with different metal oxides and produce beautiful stained glass windows. They couldn't do that initially because it's rather difficult. It takes a lot of technology to make flat sheets of glass that are big enough to cut up and create windows. So that took quite a bit more time.
So Alan, I'm sorry, Tom, go ahead.
I was going to say, what many of us who've traveled a little bit know is that Venice and Murano and that whole tradition is so world famous, still is. What's going on, or is it materials that drive where these things came into being, or just the local people that were interested in technology?
I think it's a little bit of both. You have to have the materials close by or be able to ship them to that location. Certainly in Murano, I think that's a collection of or a community of artists that have dedicated their lives for centuries to continue the tradition of working with glass. So that those families and those artists that work on the island of Murano have been there for decades Originally, they were in the city of Venice, and there were some big fires that were caused by the glass furnaces, and they expelled them off to the island of Murano because it's too dangerous to work with molten glass around structures that could potentially burn down. So that's one of the reasons why it moved out to the island of Murano, just off from Venice. But you do need to have pure, clean silica sand as one of the materials. Limestone is certainly very easily available along the Mediterranean. And the soda ash comes from burning of organic material from the marine life. So those materials are fairly easily found along the Mediterranean. The one thing, I'm not sure how close the silica is found to the island of Murano. You need a nice, clean, white beach sand without impurities in it to create the pure, clear, crystal glass that is needed for blowing.
So are there certain regions or places in the world where that's sort of well known that, you know, sand from this location or that are actually exported to make glass?
Yeah, there's a lot of places around the world. I mean, I'm most familiar with here in the U.S. Like there's some places in West Virginia, some deposits of quartz sand that are mined for use in the glass industry. Also down in like Asheville, North Carolina, there's a mining facility down in that area. So there's a lot of places in the U.S., but the quality of the sand is important. It has to have very few impurities, especially things like iron. Iron is very common in a lot of the rock formations throughout the world. And if you have iron deposits that are, or iron impurities that are in the sand, it will change the color of the glass to a brown or greenish brown color. And most glass artists, they want to start with a pure, clear glass. And so you need a very pure silica sand to do that without impurities in it. Once you have the clear glass, you can make up as much clear glass as you want. And then usually most artists coat the outside surface when they're blowing glass, at least they coat the outside surface with a very thin layer of color glass. The interior portion of the vessel is mostly clear glass, whereas the exterior portion is color glass. So that they start out with clear glass to begin the bubble of glass, and then they put an outer layer of color on the artwork as they're forming it in its molten stage. And when you see light coming through, you don't see that clear glass that makes up 90% of the vessel. All you see is the outer layer of the color that they've added onto it.
But by the time it's done, it's one piece. It's not like two layers that are glued together. They're really integral.
They are integral. They're both molten glass. They're not glued together. They're just glass when it's in its molten state is extremely sticky. It will stick to almost any hot surface. And you can't separate them once they've been come in contact with each other. So the colored glass surface on the outer layer of the clear glass is bonded just through that molten process. But color glass is very much more expensive, and you have to, if you want to do different colors, you have to have different batches of color. So you want to have your base glass being clear glass, and then you can roll or coat the outside surface into whatever color you want. And different colors of glass are more expensive. Like if you want to use pinks or reds, they're much more expensive to produce. So you don't want to use very much of that red coating or the pink coating on the outside surface of your clear glass because it's so expensive. So if you made the entire vessel out of pink glass, it would be outrageously expensive. But if you make the vessel out of mostly clear glass, just put a thin layer of this expensive colored glass on the outside surface, then the vessel becomes much more attainable as far as economics.
I'm thinking this is going to connect what you just talked about to back to, in my mind, I was thinking all the while about architecture. My first sort of sense of glass as a wow factor is, of course, Gothic cathedrals. And the fact that, you know, in some of the most amazing ones, St. Denis or some of the ones that have 80% glass, you know, as their exterior envelope, are just incredible technical achievements. But I'm not sure that technical achievements was really the driver. I'm just, you know, in thinking about this hour, you know, it struck me that maybe, you know, it was really, in a sense, the church trying to create wow factor for the basically, and, you know, in the 10th century or whenever this all started. When you think about, and this is one thing I sort of saw from living and working as an architect in Iran, where at the time 60% of the population was illiterate, you know, in the 60s when I was there. And the whole issue of the church trying to tell stories and tell a narrative in a way that, you know, that could be understood by illiterate people when only the monks could read, and half of that was Latin anyway. I don't know how do you see the sort of the inherent qualities of glass in the situation, having driven some of this, or was it, I'm trying to sort out in my mind, was it more the politics of the church trying to sort of keep the flock going and saying, oh, here's a way, you know, using glass in these incredible giant colored windows that must have made people just, you know, knock their socks off when they went into these new churches. And that stuff has lasted for over 1,000 years in some cases.
Yeah. And the stained glass windows in the cathedrals are amazing. And they, as you said, the church used those to help with the teachings and what they want to communicate to the lay people. And they can do that. And I do that in my own stained glass windows. You look to a verse and read through the wording and try and pick out things that can be translated into images or icons that can be used in the design of the window that people can understand. Even though they may not be able to read at all, they can look at a picture in stained glass window and understand the what the artist was trying to communicate, if they understand the story or the phrase or part of the Bible that the artist was trying to illustrate. They can understand that piece if they are knowledgeable about the story. They can see the people and what the artist was trying to communicate through the colors and the shapes in the glass.
That's really, you know, both of these are just so fascinating. You've woven a spin and out between science and architecture and building and religion, and that's really great. We've been talking with Alan Spencer and Thomas Huff about geology, crystals, glass, architecture, and artistry. Please join us for more conversations after a short break.
Dave Baghdad, host of the Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Hoffman-Longton.
And I'm Mark Kiesling. And today we're having a conversation about geology and glass with Thomas Huff and Alan Spencer. And before we left, there was something curious, Alan, that I really wanted to pursue with you just for a second. You talked a lot about making colored glass, and you said there was something you add. Yeah. And why was red, there was something you added, but there's a reason that red was so expensive. What was it?
Well, typically like a bright pinkish red color is probably the most expensive, and they use gold. So Whoa. You have to use gold to get that bright red pink color. It's a very vibrant, deep reddish pink. And the only way to get that is to add gold. If you add copper typically to the glass when it's melting, you're going to get green. If you add iron, it's going to get browns or brownish greens. You add cobalt, you'll get blue. So a lot of people know that cobalt is blue glass, but a lot of people don't realize that the pink, the bright pinks are so expensive, and reds are very expensive because of the metals that are added to the glass. And those metals are precious and very expensive. So that's why that glass is so expensive also.
So I would love to jump in with a question, because there's something that's really kind of gotten me thinking as you're talking, Alan, as well as you, Tom. And it's really about how we talk about science in the context of education in non-science fields. So, you know, Tom, you were talking about the idea that you've got this new design building at UMass that is really designed to be a teaching tool for your design students, the building itself. And I'm thinking, Alan, for you, as you talk with your sculpture students about some of the chemistry that is required as you think about blowing glass, you know, we often hear about art students sort of eschewing their interest in science, you know, and sort of stepping away from math and science and toward the arts. But it sounds like, you know, in both of these cases, we're really talking about kind of integrating these ideas of science into the space of design or the space of art. So, Tom, do you want to talk about that a little bit as you think about your new building?
Yes, absolutely. Because I think having been involved with other design buildings and other and many other buildings, the idea that the building itself can sort of stimulate us to think in new ways isn't just about the design students themselves, but the fact that the link to me that's really been very much fun to think about in the last 15 years is how the whole concept of sustainability has taken off in huge ways, and how the consciousness that we have about the impact we as humans have on the earth has made buildings and building materials become a much more important element in what we think about, both from a creative point of view, the whole thing of well-being, but also our impact and our footprint, our carbon footprint on the earth. Buildings and the operation of buildings use something like, I think it's 40 to 50% of all of the energy that we use on the planet has to do with buildings. It's just such a huge percentage and that, of course, and then producing the materials, whether it's glass or other materials, we've become so much more conscious of, you know, how we, in this whole thing about embodied energy in materials now that is part of this conversation. Reusing things we've already manufactured instead of making things new is part of that whole conversation. But so buildings, and I think the students that we're educating are actually, it's amazing. It has just caught fire to the point where when I first started at UMass 15 years ago, the administrators, bless their hearts, they meant well, but their first question when we talked about sustainability was, is it going to cost us more if we do that? And that whole conversation is completely reversed. So now we're sort of looking at how can we do things that cost less to operate and maintain. And glass plays a huge role in that, because the other piece of this that with the design building and another one that we just finished, a big dining commons with student centers in it, is that now the latest thing is that glass can actually be used to produce energy. Literally dynamic glass, you can actually tap the energy that comes from the sun in the glass and put it back into the building as something that you can use, which of course reduces our energy consumption and all the rest that goes with it. So I think this whole thing of looking more carefully at how we build, what we build, how to make ourselves happier occupants of an indoor environment. But then when we also can have a lower carbon footprint by using smart glass to do all of this is incredible. And then you get other things like fritted glass that gets a little more into Alan's area of adding colors and other other elements to the glass that not only make it possible to think about designs and art, you know, that's part of the glass, but also that serves practical purposes to your original point. That does other things. There's a wonderful school of management at MIT here in Boston, where most of the walls inside are glass, but they've done all kinds of designs with changing the glass from bottom to top. So it gives you either more privacy or less privacy, depending on the functions going on inside the room. And they've employed artists to come up with, you know, how that should be done to meet the needs of the occupants. So pretty cool.
I love that idea too, because it is, as you said, sort of helping, it's experiential learning for those students, right? It's an opportunity for those students to sort of, you know, as a design student, you're not just thinking about how do I make something beautiful, but you're thinking about how do I make something functional. And that function can be about environmental footprint. It can be about utility, right? In terms of the conference rooms with the, you know, glass walls or darkening or, you know, translucent glass walls. So Alan, when you're talking with your students, your sculpture students, your glass blowing students about sort of the science of this work, can you talk a little bit more about how you integrate those things together, both from an art standpoint and from a function standpoint?
Well, we try and make a lot of connections with other areas, especially things like chemistry. As the students in the art area, they're making ceramic vessels, but they're coating it with glazes. And glazes are essentially molten glass material. It's a mixture of silica, clay, and some flux material to make melt at a particular temperature, and then oxides to color it. And in the chemistry class at our school, the kids make their own glass. One of the classes they work with, it's a material science class, and they make their own glass. They do experiments with raku firing, which is a special ceramic firing, and make their own glazes, melt glass, and do tests with different materials. So there's a lot of connections between art and the sciences, especially in chemistry, because if you're doing material science, there's a lot of connection between the materials that we use and the testing that can be done in the classroom, in a science classroom, like a chemistry class, on those materials, so that the kids can explore the qualities of these materials and understand them better. And then in my class, I talk to them about what goes into making the glaze, and they understand the connections of materials like cobalt getting the glaze blue and copper turning it green. So they can learn about those connections through both of our areas of material science and in the art class that I teach.
One of the things that stuck out to me as you were speaking, Alan, was thinking about how this type of learning has the potential to change your students' appreciation for objects themselves. Sort of thinking about how my coffee cup is made, or how, you know, that intersection between art and science is one of the places where you get this newfound appreciation for an everyday object. Can you talk about how your students experience that change in attitude?
Well, the students in my classes, just at first, they learn basic skills of how to work with materials. But then as they explore the subject more and learn more about themselves and what they want to create, then they can explore how they want to design their pieces and what they want to, what materials they want to go into their sculptures, and select various materials that they think will be most useful in creating that particular artwork that will create a piece that's very functional and aesthetically beautiful.
And Tom, do you think that this is true as well? I'm thinking about these, you know, you're talking about the building at MIT or buildings that you create. Do you see your students sort of changing their perceptions of thinking about what a building is, what a building can do, because of some of these changes that you're making, whether that's in terms of environmental footprint or in terms of the science of the space?
Absolutely. I think it's what I think is interesting. I mean, the whole issue of the building envelope that we talked about with energy and all of the sustainability things, but on the inside, the whole idea of transparency and the idea that we used to live in little boxes with doors and, you know, plaster walls and such, has really the attitude towards privacy and how we really need to sort of get out of our cubicles and the whole issue of learning. I think one of the most exciting things that's going on, at least at UMass and that I've been involved with, is, you know, the whole notion of peer-to-peer learning and how that's so powerful in the whole flipped classroom concepts and all the things that, you know, you've all been dealing with too, is so much more enabled by technology and things like interior glass walls or no walls. And where glass in some cases now is more of an acoustic. So we've got acoustic glass, we have structural glass, we have glass that serves many more functions than just being transparent, because we have much more interest in the social interactivity among students or between students and TAs or whoever's working. So I think the whole thing of new pedagogies that we've learned so much from the whole notion that we sort of derogatorily talk about the stage on the stage as being, you know, something that we are trying to, you know, run away from. And to think about, I'm just imagining, I would love to be in one of Alan's classes because, you know, the hands-on, the idea that you're, to some degree, it's maybe the performance of an individual designer, but I get the feeling maybe, and maybe I'm wrong, Alan, that producing things in glass can, to some degree, be kind of a team thing. It can be interactive in the sense that different people are doing different parts of the process of creation. I don't know if that's true or not, or if it really is more of a individual effort.
Well, some projects certainly take teamwork. Like if you have ever watched Dale Chihuly and his team working on glass blowing, they typically have a whole group of artists together. Dale Chihuly will draw up a design on paper of what he wants the artwork to look like. And then he has an artist, it's called a gaffer, who actually works at blowing the glass. And then he has other helpers that help with forming it, shaping it, through the process. The other areas in doing stained glass windows, when I designed stained glass windows, I had to work with other people from the industry, woodworkers to do the framing around the opening, also metal fabricators to do the framing that would hold the windows in place. And then I would make the stained glass window, and I have to hold it all together with materials that were produced by another company, for like the lead cane or the copper foil materials that would hold the various pieces together. Because stained glass windows are essentially just a puzzle, and they're held together with either lead or copper foil with solder melted on it. And so you have to work with other materials as well as other people to create these artworks, sometimes teams of people, and each have their own specialties and know how to use the materials best to create the artwork, and the artist try and combine all these materials and processes together to create the best artwork they can.
Are there, Tom and Alan, are there things that we can't do with glass? I mean, certain shapes, can we bend it almost any way, are there some restrictions?
Well, I think there's some restrictions as far as size, because I think that's the biggest problem that almost all artists get into, whether it's blown glass or stained glass. I mean, you see these huge stained glass windows in the cathedrals, and the biggest difficulty in making these large forms, whether it's molten glass or stained glass windows, or, and I'm sure architectural windows, is just the size of it. The bigger it gets, the harder it is to control it and maneuver it, put it in place without breaking it. On glass is extremely strong, but with a little bit too much pressure, you can snap it quite easily or shatter it. So you have to be careful when you're constructing a large project. I think you can do a lot of different forms as far as bending and shaping, but the size limitations are the biggest factor.
I think on the architectural side of that, I think the size has continued to get, you know, larger and larger with the technology of structural glass. You know, we've all probably been to Toronto or the Space Needle in Seattle and stood on the glass floor that's, 1,000 feet above the ground, and kind of realize that, you know, that glass has structural properties that it didn't have before, and that's being used in other strange ways. But I'm thinking too that as an educational process that we deal with, the intersection of technologies, and I'm thinking about material science. Glass is as I've said before, kind of one of the examples of some amazing intersection between chemistry and other additives to the original formulas for glass that makes it possible now to do, you know, you've all seen the big glass, you know, two-story spaces that are enormous pieces of glass. And that was enabled by also looking at seams and structural supports. So Pilkington and some of the people in England who are particularly advanced in that area invented these silicon connectors that, because you have to deal with wind. So in buildings and all building facades, you have to deal with wind issues. And so the effect of wind on a facade, and especially on a huge piece of glass, means that it has to be, in order for it to not crack, which other building materials aren't as subject to, they had to invent flexing connections so that as the wind forces, either suction or pressure, on a giant piece of glass was absorbed by these, if you looked at some of the cool ones, and I like the aesthetics of it. If you lose these huge pieces of glass, these stainless steel things that look like the feet on a frog, you know, that are basically the structural support for these huge silicon supports that hold the glass in place, and then silicon between these sheets of glass. So it's, once you get going on all these things about material science and inventions and additives to glass that make it structural, it's really, it's endless how fascinating this whole issue is of glass as an aesthetic thing, as a human improvement thing, and as a cutting edge way to deal with sustainability. We're in the sustainability world, you know, one of the things that we went through, I think our low point in terms of lack of understanding of how we better live in our environment is maybe the 50s and 60s, where we were so fascinated with our ability to do artificial things and to create artificial places and use plastic indiscriminately and to throw everything, make everything disposable, and all the stuff that we went through, to the point now where I think glass is a big part of that whole thing, coming back to the full circle, back to the sustainability thing, where it doesn't need to be coated or painted. Once you've produced it, you know, it's, until it breaks, if it does, it's pretty much a low cost piece of a building.
So just for our guest, a reminder that we're having a conversation with Alan Spencer and Tom Huff about glass and all the properties that glass has. It's quite amazing. I can make a little pun here and say that we're going to have to move to a break, which is something we don't want to talk about in glass. But if you want to do what we do with the Da Vinci Pursuit, we encourage you to get together with friends and have a conversation around what you've heard today. And those conversations are fun for you to explore and for you to be able to talk about things that we normally don't get to talk about. And we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Tony Morris. Join me for an hour of some of the best music for guitar on Classical Guitar Alive. Each week we explore a wide variety of music with guitar, and you'll also hear interviews with many of the world's foremost performers and composers. That's each week on Classical Guitar Alive.
Saturday mornings at 5 on WICR The Diamond.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about geology, crystals, glass, glass artistry, and architecture. Today with our guests, Tom and Alan, we're so happy to have you. And when we ended, we were talking a little bit, as you mentioned, about sort of material science and thinking about the role of material science. And what I want to kind of transition to is talking a little bit about innovation. And Alan, I'm going to start with you because certainly your work looks back, thousands of years, but you're still producing art that I would ostensibly ask folks to think about sort of issues of today. So can you talk a little bit about how fossils and other sort of natural elements inform your artwork?
So I've always been interested in fossils even when I was a little kid. But I grew up in Rhode Island where there aren't very many fossils at all. And when I came to the Midwest to study at college, there's just an abundance of fossils out here. And just found those rather amazing little things that you could find in the nature. Break open a rock and find a beautiful remnants of a living creature that hasn't been seen the light of day for maybe hundreds of millions of years. And I was always fascinated with those. And after studying geology in school and starting to do my own artwork, I decided to utilize those fossils on my artwork pieces. So I researched different types of fossils. Certain fossils are known as indicators in the geologic period. Just like as an example, fishes are known in the Devonian period and in Silurian period, coral reefs. So I utilize those indicator fossils for the design for each of my pieces that I did, ceramic vessels, and incorporated the indicator fossils on each one of the 12 vessels that I made to show the geologic history of our Earth. I think it's just amazing the evolution that life has gone through in the Earth's history in the last at least 400 million years. That's about 400 million years ago is when life started becoming more recognizable and be able to be preserved in the rock formations. And the vessels that I make show those different time periods and the fossils that were most prevalent during each of those times. And it shows the evolution of life through those 400 million years too.
You brought up earlier Dale Chihuly, and that he was on my mind because somehow in my travels and going to museums and places, I personally intersected with so much Chihuly that I almost feel like he's overexposed in our country. This every museum you go to has at least one Chihuly in it, and I'm thinking, what he struck some kind of a I don't know, not a nerve exactly. I don't know what the right word is. Is he's so wildly successful and everybody wants a Chihuly, you know, yeah, in their museum lobby. But I just wanted to say that to your earlier point that I haven't always liked everything I've seen. I find some of it not to my personal taste, but I saw a huge exhibit at Biltmore in the estate in North Carolina, where his stuff was kind of planted between in the horticultural areas of, and the Biltmore Gardens are as famous as the building. And I'm curious, I found it amazingly appealing that what they were able to build and do with various forms of glass that were not directly imitative of plants, but that there were similarities in the artistry of plant forms and plant structures that I felt like I didn't want to leave. There was something about the sort of planting these glass structures in between real plants that really was provocative to, challenging.
When you're talking about that and you're from the Boston area, one of my favorite places to have gone was in Harvard, where they have plants that were fabricated out of glass, which is even more amazing to me. Can you describe for our listeners a little bit about?
Well, it's a famous collection. It was two Czech glass masters who were commissioned, who did things for teaching biology, I think, in some university in Czechoslovakia. And there were some people from Harvard. This was in the, 1880s, or I can't remember the dates. They were so thunderstruck by the perfection of the coloring and the ability to create accurate models of many, many biological samples. They basically paid them to come to the U.S. and do what they did. And this collection of, there's rooms full of, and I can't remember their names, unfortunately, where you look, you would think these were frozen plants. They are so incredibly perfect. And they were commissioned to keep on working. The story, and I don't know how much of it is true, is that they died without revealing their technical secrets. And I don't know, Alan, that somehow no one has been able to reproduce what they did in glass. And some of these things are like tendrils, stamens and pistils and things that are extremely small and thin. And it's all glass. There was, I think in a few cases they used wire to hold a few things together, but it's 98% glass.
I've never seen them in person, but I've seen photographs of the collection you're talking about. And those pieces are mostly lamp working. It's not glass blowing. So they use a very small torch and special mixtures of glass that they can do very delicate work in a small table, on a small table area, and heat up the glass with the small torches and add color to it and create these sculptures that mimic life almost perfectly.
Yeah. Well, certainly anybody listening who hasn't been to the Peabody Museum at Harvard should make sure to put that on your bucket list, because this sort of intersection between artistry and technology and science. I know, boy, that collection will truly blow you away. But to the Chihuly thing, where they weren't trying to imitate nature, but simply it was kind of like a cognate of nature. They were doing things with colors and shapes that you could almost imagine these things that were planted between, various plants that were in their garden to be, they felt very at home there. And I don't know what you feel about that kind of almost imitation. I found it, mesmerizing.
Yeah. Chihuly did a similar exhibit here in Columbus at the conservatory. And they purchased the collection because they thought it was so incredibly interactive with their natural life forms and plants. And the people go to the conservatory every year to see the pieces that Chihuly created that naturally complement all of the beautiful plant life that they have at the conservatory. And they are mesmerizing and beautiful. I enjoy going down to see them several times a year.
And it's in, that's an indoor conser- in a glass conservatory. So it's, it's not exposed to the winter weather or whatever.
There are some parts of it that they have outside, some like koi pools and some rock formations and plant life that are outside, but most of it is kept inside in like a greenhouse type, a large conservatory. And they have areas like a desert area. They'll have a tropical area, the palm house. And in the, each of those areas, they will intersperse the pieces that Chihuly designed specifically to complement the plant life in those various houses.
Has his work sort of figured into your teaching?
A little bit. That and Andy Goldsworthy. Andy Goldsworthy is one I use a lot with students and Chihuly. The interesting thing about Chihuly is, and you talked a little bit about this, that he has pieces, millions of pieces all over the world. And the main reason that is because he accidentally got, he was in a car accident in 1977, I believe, and lost the sight in one eye. So he has no depth perception. So he actually cannot, he was a glass blower at one time, but he can't blow glass anymore because he can't tell how close his hand might be to the molten material. So he hires teams of the most famous glass blowers in the world to make these artworks. And that's how he can be so prolific with all of his artwork. He's one of only three people in the world that has had an individual show at the Louvre. And the only reason he's been able to do that mainly is because he hires teams of, you know, he can hire 10 or 12 teams of artists all around the world to create these beautiful artworks.
It's all really amazing and all these intersections. We want to thank both of you, Alan Spencer and Tom Huff, for helping us explore the exciting world of glass.
You'll find pictures of their projects and those of other guests on the Da Vinci Pursuit website at thedavincipursuit.com, where we create museums without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can come together to enjoy unique activities and conversations like this one today.
And until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again next week when we explore more curiosities from the intersection of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedavincipursuit.com.